So good afternoon, everyone. If you're struggling to find a seat, just there are some in the front over here, so feel free to come and grab one. Tough crowd. That was a joke, my attempt at a joke. So welcome to this last track session on porting the E5 solution to Azure IaaS roles. Hopefully you haven't yet hit information overload, and I hope you find it a good session. I'm certainly going to enjoy delivering it. So my name's Chris Vessels, the CTO at a company called E5 Workflow. And just to give you a little bit of a background and context, E5 Workflow is the product division of a company called Dataract. And I'll just give you a quick 30-second history of Dataract. Dataract is an Australian-owned company. We were started in 1989. And we're actually originally an IBM FileNet partner. And then around 2000, we started leveraging the Microsoft technology stack. We had a classic ASP app that leveraged the FileNet e-process workflow engine, and we had some success with that. And then around 2001, 2002, we started taking notice of the emergence of SharePoint and just the amazing traction that was gaining. And we recognized a couple of things in SharePoint. So one was that Microsoft was putting a whole lot of dollars into it. So we are big fans of leveraging the Microsoft R&D budget. It's, you know, ever slightly so more than ours, and we really want to add value on top of that. So we recognized that it looked like SharePoint was going to become a full-blown document repository in its own site, in its own right, and content management system. And we also saw SharePoint as a great way to surface an application. So we could actually let SharePoint take care of a whole lot of stuff for us, like authentication, authorization. We could leverage the site hierarchy structure of SharePoint to be able to deliver different types of work to different sites that different business units within an organization have. So we started writing E5 in 2003 and surfacing it predominantly within SharePoint, and we've basically been riding that SharePoint wave ever since. So we're a Microsoft Gold partner. We're based in Sydney. We have a branch in Melbourne, and we have a branch in San Francisco. So we've got around 50 sites up in Australia. We've been particularly successful in the health sector and financial services, and then we've got a couple of sites up in the U.S., a little bit about myself. So there's my recently acquired Twitter handle within the last 2 weeks. So I finally succumbed. So if you want to join my mother and follow me on Twitter, you're welcome to do so. So a little bit of history about me. My background is I did a BSc in mechanical engineering, and there was a fairly strong computer science component to that. And it's quite interesting because recently I caught up with some of the mates that I graduated with, and more than 50% of my class actually ended up in IT. So personally, I think that engineers make the best developers, but that's just my humble yet accurate opinion. So I started working as an engineer, and I just got more and more interested in software development, and I jumped ship and became a permanent developer in 2000. 2004, I moved to Sydney with my wife and two sons, and I pretty much joined Dataract off the boat as a senior developer, then as product manager, and more recently as CTO. So just what I'm going to be covering in this session to give you a bit of an idea of where we're headed. So I'm going to give a little bit of a context and just give you a 10,000-foot view of what E5 Workflow is all about, just so you have some sort of context of what it is before we talk about how we actually go about moving this up onto the infrastructure as a service platform. The second thing I want to look at is just kind of why cloud? So as the owners and developers of E5 Workflow, why are we interested in cloud generally? And more specifically, why are we interested in infrastructure as a service? The third part over here I'm going to talk about, and I hope this makes sense to you, I've titled it Have VM, Will IaaS. So the concept over here is, and this is kind of what the brochure led me to believe when I first started looking at this, is I've got a VM provisioned in my local data center. I want to shut that thing down. I'm going to hoik it up into Azure Blob Storage. I'm going to stand up a VM, and it's just all going to work. So what I discovered, it's incredibly easy when you know what you need to know. It's an amazing thing how many things are like that, isn't it? It's like once you actually know what you need to do, yeah, it's really easy. But actually, there were a couple of things that I had to understand about how the platform was hanging together before I could do that, because infrastructure as a service is not just VMs sitting up in the sky. I can get that from other vendors. It's actually very different. It's leveraging a lot of aspects of the PaaS platform underneath. So I want to spend a little bit of time with that. And hopefully by the end of it, I don't know if anyone here is actually sitting where they're wanting to, you know, go and sign up for the preview, and they've actually got a workload on-premise that they're wanting to hook up in the cloud. If that's you, I'm going to save you a whole lot of pain. So you'll be glad you came. And then the last thing I'm going to look at is a hybrid deployment. So you've heard a lot of talk about this, but how do we actually extend our local area network out onto the cloud, essentially as a virtual branch office? and how we can start interacting between services that are hosted on-premise, services that have got hosted in the cloud, and then potentially as well services that we're hosting on PaaS. So that's where we're going. I hope that sounds good. Right, so what is E5 Workflow? So E5 Workflow is really about work allocation management. So at its essence, E5 Workflow is about making sure that the right person does the right piece of work at the right time. And there's a whole lot of that goes into that. So we strong proponents of lean methodology, and the first principle of lean is eliminate waste. So how do you eliminate waste? You make sure that the right piece of work is being done by the right person. You make sure that a high-value human resource is not doing a mundane task. You want to make sure that the kind of more critical aspects of the work are being done by the correct people. So what we try and do is we model the classification of work that an organization does. We capture that work as quickly as possible, because if you can capture it, you can make it visible. If it's visible, you can manage it. So there's a number of ways that we do that. So we integrate with Exchange Online, Exchange On-Premise. It may come through fax. It may come through a scanner. It may come through a web form on a portal. But we get it into E5 as quickly as possible. The other component then is that we model the skill sets that we have in the form of human resources. And really, E5 lives at the intersection of those two things. And usually people transact in a kind of paradigm or metaphor that we call get next. So we don't, I mean, we do, you can assign work to individuals, but we tend to rather assign work to skill sets. So I come up, I authenticate against SharePoint, I know who you are. There's a natural order of work within the organization that needs to be done. I know what your skill sets are. I can find you the next most important piece of work within the enterprise that you are skilled to do, and I'll deliver you that piece of work, and you'll transact with that piece of work until such time as either it's completed or it reaches a state that you're no longer authorized to do, and then I'm going to deliver you another one. And we're just going to keep on doing that until you say stop. And what we find is by implementing that, we tend to get about a 30% productivity improvement right out of the box before we even get too fancy with automation and workflows. We can get fancy as well. So that's kind of first two phases over there. And then within the context of that process, there's always some sort of interaction with various line of business systems. So there may be a lookup to a CRM system. We may need to submit a traction to a system to process a claim payment or something like that. So that's the 10,000 view of E5 and what it is and what it does. This is just to give you a bit of an idea of what the E5 ecosystem looks like that we're actually wanting to hoist up onto infrastructure as a service roles. So, and within the context of an enterprise, we may have a number of E5 environments. So there may be a development environment, UAT, staging, production, etc. The slide also kind of gives a little bit of a feel for the evolution, just as we began seeing the potential of the hybrid models and the hybrid deployment models that the whole cloud opportunity has been opening up. These E5 environments kind of lived isolated from each other, and we wanted to be able to create some sort of central location where I can manage these different environments, not only in the context of an enterprise, but actually spanning deployments that may be on-premise and deployments that may be up in the cloud. So an E5 environment correlates to a SharePoint farm. That SharePoint farm may have any number of web applications. Those web applications may have any number of site collections. Is everyone pretty familiar with SharePoint over here? That looks like a general consensus, yes, yeah, great. Okay, and an instance of E5 will manifest within the context of a site collection. So prior to 2010, I could manage that instance of E5 within that context of that site collection. What we then started building out was a set of WCF services to wrap our API to begin exposing these environments over here to a kind of central client. So the metaphor, this is called E5 Studio, and the metaphor it really is, it's like SQL Management Studio, where I can walk up to a SQL Management client, and I can go and connect to any SQL Server instance that I have access to, and I can go and then administrate that SQL Server instance based on the authority level that I have. Much the same with E5 Studio, except we deliver it via click once from a publishing service. E5 Studio will call out to a directory service, which exposes a catalog of the environments that I'm able to access. And I'm then able to go and see the instances of E5 within that environment and manage them. And also begin to manage the migration. For example, you may want to promote from UAT to staging to production, etc. As I mentioned already, there's some integration going on with Office 365 in the form of Exchange Online, so some SaaS integration. And what this talk is really about is we wanted to take, you know, a whole E5 environment and just hoist it up into the cloud. Okay, so I'm going to demo is probably too large a word because this talk is actually about infrastructure as a service. But I just want you to see E5 just to give you a little bit of a context. So what I'm going to do over here is just open up E5 Studio. So what it did was it went out to that publishing service. You'll notice it's authenticating me as Chris. So I'm actually logged into my to our domain. And I've authenticated against my service, against our on-premise domain, which I think is very cool. That blows my hair back, which you can't see. There is just one little hair over here, and it's blown right back. So here I am. I'm able to go and connect, and I'm connecting to that directory service. And what you'll notice over here is this host. So I have E5. Can you guys see that around? E5 Azure on IaaS, and you'll notice over here that the host is my DNS name, .cloudapp.net. So that's the namespace of Azure. So when I go and connect to that, it's going and hitting my services in the cloud, and I'm now able to go and see the instances of E5 that I've gotten with that, within that environment. And E5 Studio is where I build out the classification of work, where I specify document repositories, I specify locale, templates for document generation, for email generation, and where I start to associate workflows with different classifications of work. So if you want to know more about E5, please go to our site. So I put that up on the slide in the beginning, but it was dataact.com.au or e5workflow.com, and there's some great screencasts on there that'll give you an idea of what E5 does. So I mentioned it's surfaced within SharePoint, so the administration experience is from within E5 Studio. The processor experience is typically within SharePoint. So you'll notice, again, that namespace up at the top there. So this is actually sitting running in Windows Azure Infrastructure as a Service. And we'll create the experience by dropping E5 web parts onto different pages within SharePoint to create that experience. All right, so that's the 100,000-foot view of E5. So what's under the hood? Let's just talk a little bit about the technology stack. So we sit on top of Windows Server 2008 R2. I didn't mean to build that up quite so quickly, but that's all right. We'll just walk through it. I was actually aiming for the little red light pointer thing, and it built out. 2008 R2, soon to be 2012. So we've got processes executing on the .NET 4.0 CLR, and because we've still got code executing in the SharePoint 10 process, that's still on .NET 2 CLR, leveraging .NET Framework 4. We've got this framework over here, which just enforces consistency around the way that we build out service verticals, notifications, diagnostics, etc. We support SQL Server 2008 R2 and SQL Server 2012. This is our services layer over here. So this workflow service over here is managing the execution of the workflows that have been designed within E5 Studio. We sit on top of what we surface in SharePoint 2010, soon to be by the end of the year 2013. This is our object model sitting up over here with our DAL and various services that execute within E5. Then we've got this application facade up over here, which just abstracts clients from our services. And the primary client experience is via browser. We've got a Silverlight viewer, but we support the plugging in of other third-party viewers. We have a BI semantic model that we're surfacing in PowerView and PowerPivot and E5 Studio, which one of the main reasons that we went for WPF, apart from the fact that it's very cool, is we wanted to be able to rehost the W4 designer side by side with the case assets we design in E5, because then I can just drag and drop those assets onto the workflow designer and wire them up. So again, if you want to have a look at that, have a look at the screencast on our site. All right, so that brings us to the next part of the session, which is, well, why cloud? Why are we interested in the cloud? So the first and most obvious reason is a commercial one. So the biggest barrier to entry in a solution like E5 when you wanting to go out and get it into the marketplace is the infrastructure, the upfront capex spend. So people have to go and procure a whole lot of infrastructure. They've got to go and provision that infrastructure. They've got to stand up a SharePoint farm and get E5 running, and there's a lot of upfront cost. If you can eliminate that, there's a much easier entry into the market. They can achieve faster ROI, which is good for them, good for us. We can achieve economies of scale through multi-tenanting. So, you know, our clients are interested in consuming our service. They're not really interested in managing infrastructure. And to me, it's been really interesting. So just kind of through this short career that I've had in IT of 12 years now, but just seeing the evolution of the industry and how I worked a lot in the banking sector when I was still in South Africa. And you kind of go into a bank and it felt like an IT shop that was dabbling in IT. Do you know what I mean? Just the amount of resource that organizations have to invest in managing IT infrastructure just to be able to support the software services that they're really wanting to consume. And of course, they're just interested in that service. If I can multi-tenant it and deliver it to them, they're quite happy with that as long as they get the performance that they're looking for. Highly available fault-tolerant deployments at a radically reduced cost. But the more I kind of think about this whole hybrid deployment model and the opportunity offered by infrastructure as a service, the more kind of ideas and opportunities one starts to see. So one of the things is, you know, we're a fairly small organization. The cost for us to actually stand up at a hot DR site or even a cold DR site is prohibitive. But we've got a lot of IP sitting on our infrastructure that's sitting in our office in Sydney. And, you know, all of a sudden you've got something like infrastructure as a service where you can stand up a virtual network. So you've essentially got a branch office up in the cloud. And I can now leverage failover groups within SQL Server 2012 and have an async secondary sitting out in the cloud at a very, very cheap cost. And I've essentially, and I can stand up a full-blown hot DR site up there for a fraction of the cost that it would cost, you know, cost me to set up something like that at a different location. Our internal environment. So we're a software house. We're not really interested in keeping, we don't have people full-time dedicated to maintaining our infrastructure. If one of our servers throws a disk, then between us, we go and sort that out. So it takes one of my resources and it gets them off doing something other than building E5, which is what I want them preoccupied with. So we use E5 for our sales contracts and support systems internally. We want to run those up in the cloud. The hybrid opportunities that, you know, the site-to-site connectivity offers within infrastructure as a service. One of the other opportunities as well is moving high-demand services like our workflow service out onto PaaS. So to me, PaaS is the nirvana of cloud, and I'll talk about that a little bit more in a moment. Application lifecycle. So this is a good one. So being an ex-engineer, I'm pretty obsessed with automation and just the value that we can derive from that. So we've been putting a lot of effort into our application lifecycle management. So we have nightly builds. When those builds have executed and everything's compiled, there's a series of unit and integration tests that run. And then there's a whole lot of deployments that take place out to different environments. But all of that infrastructure, it's a virtualized environment, but it's all sitting on-premise. I'm going to show you a very cool PowerShell script later on that I want to start to leverage in terms of our ALM. And what I can do is actually deploy these environments out to the cloud. So I can have any number of them because I want to have a standalone deployment. I want to have a multi-server deployment. I want deployments with different authentication models, et cetera. So I can make sure that you know, the latest build is still deploying out to those different environments. And then with a PowerShell script, I can actually export the configuration of that virtualized environment and shut it down. Because one of the things that you'll come to realize, so as you begin to look at infrastructure as a service and the pricing model, your storage is very, very cheap. In fact, the really cool thing about Azure Blob Storage is you actually only pay for the data that you've got stored out there. So you can stand up a 1 terabyte disk, but if you've only got 10 meg of data on that disk, you're only paying for that 10 meg of data. Where you're paying is for your compute, and your compute cost is associated with the virtual machines that you're standing up. And even if you shut those virtual machines down, you're still incurring the cost of those machines. So what you actually want to do is delete those virtual machines and just keep your disks in Azure Blob Storage. Very simple PowerShell script, export that configuration, shut down the virtual machine, delete the cloud service, and now if I want to stand that up again, I just import that configuration and new VM off it, and in a couple of minutes, I've got my environment up and running. I can do what I need to do and then tear it all back down again. That makes a whole lot of sense to me. All right, so we've already covered this traditional BPM project spend, this big upfront cost over here. What we've always tried to focus on within E5 is just really trying to put a lot of effort into lowering this initial cost over here. Because you want to get over this hump and as fast as possible get to the point where the client is actually deriving value from our software and not just seeing money go out the door. Cloud completely eliminates that. We can go in and it actually opens up completely new sales models and sales opportunities where people can actually start paying for our software when they start using it, or at the initiation of the project at least. Alrighty, so why infrastructure as a service specifically? Because a lot of those things I can get hold of from any cloud vendor. All right, so here's, I figured you guys by this stage would be tired of kind of 2D graphics, so we've gone a little bit 3D and funky again. Hope you appreciate that. So to me, You know, and this is one thing where I think Microsoft has really, really got it right, again, in my humble yet accurate opinion. PaaS delivers the true promise of the cloud. The true promise of the cloud to me as a software vendor is my software on Microsoft's infrastructure on demand at scale. This is where I start to derive the promise of elasticity, where I can scale out on demand and scale back in again very, very easily. That's where I want to get to, okay? So there's this super highway up here called Windows Azure and Platform as a Service. And like so many things in life, there's kind of where I want to be, and then there's a reality check of where I am. So here I am sitting down over here with this E5 ecosystem, and I've got the super highway up over my head that I can access because we're sitting on top of SharePoint, and SharePoint can't be deployed to a PaaS web role. So what happens? So I'm kind of one of the, there's a couple of, as I get older, there's things boil down to a couple of principles that I become more and more obsessed with. So one of the principles I'm obsessed with is convergence. There's a place I want to get to, and there's the reality of where I am right now. If I look at that, the big picture, it's kind of overwhelming at how much I actually need to do to get there. Like there's a place I want to get E5 to, and there's a place where it currently is at. What I do, what keeps me sleeping at night, is we just keep putting our effort to make sure that every single day we're taking another step towards that goal. So we're on this path of convergence. We just do a little bit better today than we did it yesterday, and we're going to get there. Infrastructure as a service has just given me this on-ramp into this world of Windows Azure, where I can actually move this environment as is up onto the infrastructure as a service platform. I'm starting to leverage a whole lot of the value out of things like Azure Blob Storage, around the fault tolerance of my data storage, the performance benefits, the massive IOPS, that kind of thing. And what I'm also now is I'm in this world where potentially I can take some of my high demand services and start moving them out onto a PaaS web role, and this whole hybrid architecture begins to emerge. You like that slide? I think it's quite cool. Okay, so let's get going. Infrastructure as a service, how do we get started? So this is a level 200 session, so I've kind of come into this pretty much on the assumption that it's people who have an interest in infrastructure as a service but haven't necessarily started using it. Is anyone actually using it? Have you got a subscription to the preview? Anyone here? One at the back there, awesome. And you as well. Okay, great. Three. Excellent. Okay, so some of this stuff to you guys is going to be a bit like, are you for real? So let's talk about managing the platform. So the way that you manage the platform is through a REST API. And the major tools that you're going to leverage is the web portal, the Azure Management Portal, and PowerShell commandlets. So there's the Windows Azure commandlets that are available for download. All of those actually communicate with the platform via that same REST API. So you can either go directly to that, use the Management Portal, or if you really want more explicit control, use the PowerShell scripts. Okay, so we get onto this have VM will IaaS portion over here that I'm going to walk you through. So a couple of prerequisites to make this work. So fairly obviously, you're first of all going to have a subscription. So infrastructure as a service is still in preview at the moment. You need to go to and apply for a subscription to the preview, and I'm pretty sure you'll be able to still get hold of that. The second thing you're going to need is a storage account. So like I said, our disks are actually going to be stored in Azure Blob Storage, and you're going to have a storage account so that you can move those up there. You're going to need an X509 certificate, so we're going to need to create a management certificate and register that with Azure so that we can secure our communication when we're using the command line tools and are starting to upload data from on-premise into the cloud. You're going to need a provisioned VM in your data center. So this one over here, it's not just any VHD that's lying around. There's a couple of boxes that you have to tick if you want to actually do this successfully. So this is the part that I want to walk you through. This is the part where I got myself in a world of pain. And if you just understand a couple of things, it's actually really easy to do. Okay, so a couple of considerations. So when you create a disk up in Azure, or not a disk rather, there's two assets that you can create within Windows Azure that you can stand up a VM of. So one is you can create an image, and one is you can create a disk. So the difference between those two is very simple. The image is just a read-only VHD, and what you're going to do when you want to new up a virtual machine off that VHD, it's actually going to create a copy of that VHD, and it's going to boot up off that copy. It won't boot up off your VHD that you put in there. So that's great if you want to baseline a VHD. So I'll show you a little bit later a command shell script where if I want to scale out one of my tiers, I can simply go and provision that through PowerShell off a base image. I can join it to my domain, and I can actually scale out that tier very quickly and easily. So generalization, if you want to create an image in the cloud off a disk that you got on-premise, you're going to have to run sysprep and generalize it. If you're familiar with SharePoint, you know that SharePoint, a provision instance of SharePoint, and sysprep are not very happy bedfellows. In fact, you'll break your configuration, and you're going to have to go and run SharePoint config. So for me to just, you know, I want this, as the brochure promised, I want my running VHD on-premise. I want to shut it down. I want to put it up into Azure Blob storage, and I just want to stand up a VHD, and it's just a virtual machine, rather, and it's going to work. Second thing is ISVMs only support one NIC currently. So again, the platform is in preview. If you've got a dependency on multiple NICs, you're going to have a problem there. Third-party licensing is another consideration that you maybe just want to be aware of. So just make sure if there are any dependencies on third-party libraries that there might be some sort of implications around the licensing. So when we're uploading a non-generalized thing, so if we've got a generalized VHD, it's actually pretty simple, and it's all just going to work, and you're going to go and create a new virtual machine off that VHD. If you're uploading non-generalized, there are a couple of things that you need to be aware of. So the first thing is, and again, it's kind of stating the obvious, but believe me, it's really frustrating to take 7 hours or whatever to upload 30 gigs of data. You know, you leave it happening overnight, and you come in the morning all excited, and you're going to stand up your virtual machine, and everything's cool, your virtual machine stands up, and whoops, I haven't enabled RDP, and now I've got absolutely no way of getting into that, of connecting to that machine. So I have heard of someone who did that. I'm not going to mention his name. So the second thing is around your network settings. Make sure there are no static settings. Rely on DHCP. Remember the admin passwords. So remember, we're not talking about virtual networks or anything at this stage. We're just talking about a VHD. I've got an Azure subscription. I've got a storage account. I want to put that VHD in there, and I want to stand up a virtual machine. So if that virtual machine is joined to your domain, you're not going to be able to use that domain credential to log into it here. Make sure that you've got a local account with admin access so you can actually get into it. No dynamic disks, fixed size only. So the hypervisor in infrastructure as a service at the moment only supports fixed size disks. If you upload a dynamic disk, it's not going to work. The takeaway from all of that is use CS Upload. So CS Upload is a utility that comes with the Windows Azure SDK. You got to save. There's other utilities that you can use, and we'll talk about some of those as we go along. And you can take your VHD and you can put it up into your storage account. You can specify the correct blob type and all of that. But CS Upload is going to do a whole lot more for you, and it's a far more efficient way of doing it. So just a couple of points on reasons to prefer CS Upload. The first is it'll convert the dynamic disks for you, so you don't have to worry about converting to fixed-size disks. Next thing is, before you think, shock, horror, I'm going to convert to a fixed-size disk, and now I've got to ship this entire VHD up into the cloud, is that CS Upload is actually smart enough to realize the sparse nature of VHDs, and it'll actually only upload the portions of that VHD that have data written to them, and the rest it'll leave behind. Now, when I read that kind of thing, I don't know if it's just because I'm approaching my mid-40s and I've become a little bit cynical, but I thought I'd go and try that out this morning. So what I did was I just created, if I can just find it, there's the sysprep command. What I did was just locally I created a VHD, and I called that Oh Really with my cynical bent. So I created a 50 gig VHD, and I ran CS Upload, and here's the results over here. So it did take a little bit of time to create a hash, so that took 12 minutes, but then it went in and basically checked out for blocks that had data written to them, and the actual upload took 38 seconds. And that was just on the Wi-Fi outside, so that was for a 50 gig. So it does do exactly what it says. It only uploads the portions of the disk that have data written to them. I like that. It'll specify the correct blob type. So within Azure Blob Storage, you've got two blob types that you can create. You can create block types, and you can create page blobs. If you wanted to stand up a VHD, it's got to be a page blob because it's optimized for I/O. Does anyone know what the maximum size of that page blob is that you can create in Azure Blob Storage? Anybody? 1 terabyte. So you can create a 1 terabyte blob. If you create an extra large image, you can attach 16 disks to that extra large VM, and you can actually go and strap those 16 disks into one volume if you like, so you can create a 16 terabyte volume. it'll create the disk of the blob for you. So when you actually, if you use another tool, so you can use another tool just to upload that blob into Azure Blob Storage, but then you're going to have to, as an additional step, actually go and create a disk of that blob. CS Upload will take care of that for you. It supports resume, so another biggie. If you're uploading a big chunk of data and it's taking 7 hours and the connection goes down, it's really nice to know that you're not going to have to start from the beginning. All right, so tooling. Oh, my gosh, we're going to have to speed up a bit. Windows Azure SDK, if you go and search for these, you can download them really easy. You're going to want to get hold of those. A couple of useful tools that I've discovered along the way. Are people mostly IT pros here? Are there some developers? Who's IT pro? Are the rest of you developers? Who won't put their hand up no matter what I ask? Thank you. Okay, I thought we'd kind of have majority IT pros. So you guys who, I'm a bit of a PowerShell rookie, but PowerGUI was absolute lifesaver for me, so it's a great IDE for authoring and executing PowerShell scripts. Cloud Explorer and CloudBerry were just useful tools that I came across. These things are all free, and they give you a nice kind of file explorer type view that lets you have side-by-side your storage accounts and the containers within those and your local file system. Okay, a couple of concepts that we're going to cover just in the section of getting a VHD up there and provisioning a virtual machine off it. We're going to talk a bit more about management certificates, Azure Blob Storage, disks, cloud services, and endpoints. So I'm going to explain each of these concepts as we go through so that there's a little bit of context, and hopefully it'll make more sense to you then. All right, so let's jump into a demo. So you'll be very pleased to know that you're not actually going to sit there for 7 hours while we upload 30 gig of data. Okay, so the first thing we're going to need to do is create a storage account. So I'm going to jump across into the portal. This is very simple to do. I told you I'm going to walk you through this. We just simply go and create new storage account, quick create, and we're going to have to go and specify a unique name for it over here so we can access it. My new storage account. So the fabric is going to go and check to see if that's unique within the context of that namespace. Okay, we're going to talk about affinity groups a little bit later when we start talking about multi-server deployments. But for now, what you're going to want to do is go and choose a region that's closest to where you're going to be accessing this from. So for us in Australia, that is Southeast Asia. So over here, we start to talk a little bit about the value of Azure Blob Storage. So you've got this little option over here to enable geo-replication. Enabling geo-replication is going to do two things. You're going to pay a little bit more for your storage, but the other thing that it's going to do is actually do, so every time you write to disk, it's actually going to do an async copy to an offsite location. So Azure Blob Storage, and we'll talk a little bit about more, but there's a number of things that it's doing. One of them, it's triplicating your data within the data center right off the bat. And if you enable geo-replication, you've got the additional redundancy that you've got an offsite backup that you can recover from if the entire data center goes down. All right, so I've already got a couple of storage accounts over here. So the next thing you're going to need to do is go and create a management certificate. So there's a couple of ways that you can do that as well. The easiest way is just to open up a Visual Studio command prompt and go and execute this make cert command and just specify the certificate name that you want. That's going to create you an X509 certificate, and it's going to install it into your local certificate store. Nice and easy. Once you've done that, so there's a couple of things here. The management portal, again, it's in preview, and I find that I had to kind of jump from time to time from the new management portal back to the old management portal, sometimes to some sort of tool, depending what it was that I wanted to do. So it's worth being aware of these things, because it's going to save you some time figuring them out. So to register that management certificate, we've got to go to the old portal. There is this little link over here to take me to the previous portal. And I've got that loaded up already, so I can see my hosted service, storage accounts, content delivery network. Here I've got my management certificates. So this is the one over here that I'm going to be using. And I can just simply go and add the certificate. There's my creatively named subscription one. And I'll browse that certificate file, and it's going to upload that and register that with Windows Azure so that I can secure that connection to upload my VHD. Right, so how do we actually go and do that? with CS Upload. So you can go and have a look at CS Upload and get some help on the commands that it offers. But just to show you the format of that. So if you wanted to do this and you just refer back to this Prezo, you'll have absolutely everything that you need to get this up and running. So the first thing you want to do is go and set the connection and the two pieces of information that you're going to need there. So the one is a subscription ID and the other is a certificate thumbprint. So those you're able to go and access again back over here. Now I've been warned about audiences at TechEd, so I'm going to be nice and quick on this and make sure I delete the subscription afterwards so someone doesn't decide to go and wreak havoc for a bit of fun. But there's my certificate thumbprint over there. And the second piece of information that I need to connect to the storage account, of course, you're going to need the on-premise certificate as well, so there's not too much havoc you can wreak. There's my subscription ID down over there. So I simply copy and paste those across into that command, and I'm going to establish that connection. And I only have to do that once, and then every time I go and execute a CS upload command, it's going to use that, that connection. So the second thing that I'm going to do is go and execute this add disk. So if I wanted to upload a generalized image, then there's another command called add persistent VM. But I want to preserve the provisioning of this disk and just new up a new VHD. So this blob storage URL that you can easily get, so back in the management portal over here, if you go into that storage account, you can see your blob URL down over there. So you just got to go and grab that. And then it says your images folder. So this one tripped me up initially, and I thought, well, what the heck is that? What that is you'll notice in these storage accounts over here that there's something called containers. And when you create a new storage account, there's not actually going to be any containers in that storage account. So once I figured out what it was, well, then it was, well, how the heck do I create a container? So I couldn't see any way to do that within the management portal. I couldn't see a way to do that within the old portal. So that's where one of these third-party tools came to the rescue. So this is Cloud Explorer over here. And you can see my local file system. You can see my two storage accounts that I've got up in Azure. And from here, I can simply go and create a new container. And I can then put that into that script over here, and that's where it's going to go and logically store that VHD. That's my VHD name. That's my label that I'm going to refer to, that VHD bar. And then I'll just have a literal path, which is the path to the local VHD on my file system. And this one over here, so we start at this point to need to talk about the different disk types that you have within infrastructure as a service. So you can either create an OS disk or you can create a data disk. And what CS Upload is going to do for you, if you specify this OS switch over here, amazingly enough, it's going to create an OS disk, yeah? Cigar for the man in the front. If you don't specify that, it's going to create a data disk. The difference in this comes down to caching. So our disks are actually stored in Azure Blob Storage, and for the OS disk, because there's a high degree of locality when to the Windows operating system, is it actually makes sense to have a local read-write cache. So the problem with that for data, so if you've got your data and your transaction logs files for SQL Server, if that buffer hasn't been flushed and it goes down, you're actually going to lose that data. So the takeaway from that is anything that you want to make sure that there's no potential data loss, you want to put that out on a data disk, and everything else you can put on your OS disk. So you can control that caching policy through PowerShell as well. So there may be a scenario where it makes sense to you to create a data disk with caching or vice versa. So this is the command over here that I executed to upload that O'Reilly VHD. There it is over there. So it has its label, it has its path, and off you go. It creates a data disk up in Azure Blob Storage. Okay, so at that point, I've got my VHDs up here, so I can go and see those. So it's created the blobs in Blob Storage. And if I go to my virtual machines and take a look at my disks, I can see I've got a number of disks over here that are already associated or attached to virtual machines. And these are the two that I uploaded previously. So what I actually did was on-prem, I already split out my data files and my transaction log files onto a separate VHD. You can also do that once you're up in the cloud, but I wanted to do it this way just to show you a way of provisioning this with PowerShell. So I've got essentially two options at this point. I can go through the management portal and I can create a new virtual machine off that disk. The downside of that is that it's actually going to start up that virtual machine just with my OS disk. My services are going to start up. SQL Server is going to try and go and find its data and transaction log files, and that drive doesn't exist. So you're then going to have to go after the fact and attach that data disk and then reboot the machine to get going. So a better way of doing this is with PowerShell. So here's a PowerShell script over here, and what I'm going to do is just execute it to get going, because this is going to take a couple of minutes to provision, so it gives me an opportunity to talk to you while that happens, and I'm going to come back in a moment and just walk you through the script. But while that's happening, it feels like a cooking show. Here's one I prepared earlier. And what I'll do is just walk you through quickly what you do to go and create this through the management portal, and we can talk through some of the other concepts that you need to understand as well as we go through. So when I create a virtual machine within the management portal, I've got a couple of options over here. I've got my platform images. So these are the images that the infrastructure has actually provided for me to create new virtual machines off. I've then got my images. So these are some baselines that I've taken. So I can create those either by generalizing on-premise and using CS Upload to get them up there, and that'll create an image for me. Or I can also provision an environment within Azure Infrastructure as a Service. I can then capture that image, and that'll save it as an image for me to be able to use as a baseline. So I've got this app server baseline that I can use to scale up my application tier. And then I've then got my disks. That E5 Sandbox one is busy being used at the moment to provision that new virtual machine. I've got another one over here that I can use just to walk you through what this looks like. Oh, we're going to have to drop this out the way. There we go. Okay, so what we do over here is give it a name. Then we've got these different virtual machine sizes. So the difference with these sizes, and apart from the fact that you're going to incur different costs, and you've obviously got different capacity on them, there's also a limit to how many disks you can attach to each size. So it goes down in halves from 16 on the extra large to 8 on the large to 4 on the medium, etc., until you get down to 1 on the extra small. So I'll specify a medium. Okay, so at this point over here, what I need to do is introduce the concept of a cloud service. So what it's saying over here, I can create a standalone virtual machine, or I can connect to an existing virtual machine. So I'm going to jump back to the deck for a moment. I've got a slide yet to talk. Okay, this was just a slide to talk about the Azure Blob storage, but I've already discussed that with you. It's the fact that our data is being triplicated. So that's what it means by persistent storage on persistent VMs. There's another cool thing about Azure Blob storage before we go to the cloud services, and that's that it's actually optimizing your data access as well. So I'm not sure if you're aware of that, but it'll actually monitor and establish access patterns for your data, and it'll begin distributing that data across multiple servers to actually optimize the performance when you're retrieving data. So the recommendation is, if you're wanting to do some load tests or some benchmarks, is that you actually hammer it for an hour or so first and allow it to actually distribute that data, and you'll get better results. A little extra piece of advice for free. So a cloud service. So if we take that standalone option, what actually happens is it'll create my virtual machine, and it'll go and create a cloud service for that virtual machine. A cloud service, I like to think of, it's a container. It's a management, configuration, security, networking, and service model container. And it's kind of a little bit confusing at first, because within the management portal, if I create a standalone virtual machine, it creates this cloud service for me implicitly, but when I go and look at my cloud services, it's not actually listed there. But if you go across to the old portal, it is listed there. And then if I add another virtual machine to that cloud service, then I'll see it manifest there. Or if I delete that virtual machine, then I'll see that cloud service over there. So it's just something to be aware of, because it can be confusing. So that's what's going to happen if I choose that standalone option. The other option that I had is that I can connect to an existing machine. So you'll notice when I say standalone option, it's asking me to provide a DNS name. That DNS name is going to be the unique name by which I access that particular cloud service, or the services hosted on the VMs within that cloud service. If I choose to connect to an existing virtual machine, and I go and specify that virtual machine, each of these virtual machines will either be part of a cloud service, or they might be standalone within the context of a cloud service. And my second virtual machine is going to be placed within that, within the context of that cloud service as well. So a couple of things to understand about cloud services is, so there goes my second VM, where I've said, okay, well, I actually want to connect this to VM1. All my virtual machines within the context of a cloud service can see each other, even if they're on separate subnets. So the fabric is actually taking care of the routing of traffic between subnets for me. And at the moment, you've actually got no control over that. Apparently, that is going to come in the future. So right now, there's no real value to multiple subnets within the context of a virtual network, but it's still good practice to introduce that, because you will, in future, be able to control network traffic between the subnets. So how then do I expose the services that I've got within the context of this cloud service to the outside world? Well, the answer is that I open up endpoints. So that's the next concept that I want to introduce, is the concept of endpoints. So I can specify either in the management portal or through PowerShell endpoints. And in the case of RDP, what I need to do, so endpoints actually use a concept called port forwarding. So the RDP port number is 3389, so I want to access VM1 and VM2 over my RDP protocol on that port, but I'm doing it via the cloud service, so how does it know which one to take me to? The answer is that I actually have a public port that's unique within the context of this cloud service. So that number over there, whatever it is, may correlate to VM1, and the 9-1 correlate to VM2. I can specify anything that I want. If I've created in the management portal, it'll just do it for me. And when traffic hits that, public traffic hits that port over there, the cloud service is going to route it through to the relevant virtual machine, and I'll be able to RDP to it. So that's cloud services. Does that make sense? That's a yes. Let's go back over here. Let's go and see how we're doing. Okay, so the next thing that I'm going to have to specify, so I may have my DNS name over there. That's going to verify that that's unique within the context of that namespace. And then I specify a region and affinity group or virtual network. So if I specify virtual networks, I've already established a virtual network that we're going to talk about a little bit later. At the moment, the limitation is if I specify I want to put this on a virtual network, there can only be one affinity group associated with that. So what's an affinity group? An affinity group is a way of indicating to the fabric controller that when it stands up these virtual machines and you specify I want these as part of the same affinity group, that's going to determine where these virtual machines are actually going to be placed in the data center. So if you've seen some pictures of these data centers, they're absolutely massive, and you don't really want your SQL server sitting in the one corner of the data center and one of your application servers or web front-end server sitting in the other end. So to minimize latency, it'll make sure that these things are closely located within the context of the data center. And availability sets we'll come back to when we start talking about fault domains and update domains. So that's how one would go and create this virtual machine through the management portal. But you can see over there it's actually now provisioned the C5 sandbox off the PowerShell script. I'm just going to walk you through that script quickly to show you what we did there. So essentially in this PowerShell script, we're doing pretty much exactly what we were doing through the management portal. So I'm specifying a virtual machine name. I'm specifying the name of my operating system disk. So that's that literal that we specified when we executed that CS upload command. And I'm specifying the name of my data disk. I'm then setting my Azure subscription. So that's the name of my subscription over there and the storage account in which these disks are residing. And then I'm piping these commands together over here to basically create the configuration for this VM. So I'm specifying my VM name, the instance size of medium, the name of the OS disk. And I'm actually explicitly specifying my host caching over here just to reinforce this concept of the difference between an OS disk and a data disk and the caching policy that you specify. So I can specify what I want through the PowerShell commandment. If I actually don't specify a value there, the fabric is just going to take care of it for me, and it's going to create the appropriate disk based on whether it's an OS disk or a data disk. I'm then going to go and add the Azure data disk. So again, the advantage of doing it via PowerShell is I'm not having to go and new up the operating system disk and then after the fact come and add the data disk. I can actually do that all in the context of this one command. I can specify the LUN that I want to create that, add that disk on, and I'm specifying a host caching policy of none. when I create my VM through the management portal, it's actually going to go and implicitly create an RDP endpoint for me. If I'm doing it through PowerShell, I need to explicitly do that. I'm a fan of explicit, personally. So I'm adding two endpoints over here. So again, that port forwarding concept. I specified a private port, which is the RDP port of 3389, and I've specified a public port so that we can utilize port forwarding to be able to remote desktop to this client. And then we're adding another endpoint over there, so I've just opened this up to the public internet over HTTP, so over port 80. So once this thing is stood up, we should actually be able to go and access the site over the public internet. And this looks like it's stood up, so let's go and try that. So I happen to know that on that sandbox environment, I've got a SharePoint site sitting at this URL, and that looks good. It's throwing up the authentication challenge, if I can remember the password. So it's starting up a SharePoint site, which always takes a little bit of time. We'll come back to that. So I'm adding that endpoint on port 80, and then I simply go and say, right, new Azure VM. I specify the name of the service. So I explicitly say what that's that DNS name that we specified in the management portal. I pass through that configuration for the VM, and I'm specifying an affinity group of DSA. So that's an affinity group that I already created. So this is going to closely co-locate this virtual machine to the other virtual machines that I've got within the context of that affinity group. Okay, let's just take, there it is. So bingo, I've got my sandbox virtual machine that I had running on premise, and I've got it up and it's running in the cloud, and I've actually exposed it to the public internet as well. Okay, so I promised you earlier on that I would show you, and this to me is kind of really useful. So, you know, we've got a bunch of developers, and developers need a dev environment, and we want them to be able to stand this up really quickly. So if I have a baseline dev environment, or maybe just in this case, this is just a sandbox environment. So it's just an environment that we have within an organization. If somebody just wants to go and play around with some stuff, build some custom workflow activities, that sort of thing. So you want to have this environment available, but I don't want it out there running, so I'm incurring a compute cost, so I actually want to shut that thing down, and when someone wants it, I just want to stand it up easily. So in order to accommodate that, what you can do is take advantage of this, these PowerShell commandlets over here. So I can specify my Azure service name. If I'm not sure what the service name is, I can go and execute this command over here and get a list of the service names in that subscription. Just pull up that result down there. So I'm going to specify the name of my virtual machine and the name of the service. I've got another script in here as well that'll take, so I can just point it at it, because the other way that you can use this is to point it at an entire cloud service that may have multiple virtual machines within it, and you can spit out the configuration for all those virtual machines. And again, you can import the entire environment and stand it up again very easily. I'm then going to specify a path to where I wanted to create this config file. And then I'm going to execute this export Azure VM command over here, giving it the service name, the virtual machine name, and the path where I want that config file to go to. So if I execute that, it'll take a couple of seconds. But if I go to that path, there we go, it's up. 2:39 p.m., that's us. So there's the state of that sandbox environment, and it's got the complete configuration set over here, so you can see the endpoints that I specified. You can see the data disk that I've got attached on LUN 0. You can see the logical disk size. You can see the OS disk down over here. You can see the role name and the role size, and the fact that it's a persistent VM role as a role type. So with that config file in place, what I can do now is go back over here, and I can actually, so if I execute this remove Azure VM, what it's actually going to do is shut down that virtual machine and delete it. So I'm no longer incurring a compute charge for that virtual machine. So I'm going to go ahead and do that. We'll execute that one first. Because what you'll notice is, if you do that, so remember I said to you, when you create a standalone, you only see one cloud service. I've only got one cloud service at the moment, which is my multiple server environment. What will happen is once that E5 sandbox virtual machine has been shut down and deleted, we'll actually see two cloud services in there, and that just gives me the opportunity to go and delete it then. That'll take a few seconds. Take my word for it. Trust me, I'm an ex-South African. Okay, that's still executing that script. So the next thing we can go and do after that is I can actually execute this one here. So when I delete the virtual machine, I actually want to go and delete the cloud service as well, because that's going to free up that name on the DNS. So once that's done, and it'll take a couple of minutes, I've now shut down my virtual machine. I'm not incurring a compute charge, but now I want to go and actually stand up this environment again, because somebody needs a sandbox to play in, or I need my sandbox to play in, and then I'm simply going to go and execute this import Azure VM command. I'm going to pass it that path. That's going to generate me the config, which I'm going to pipe through to this new Azure VM commandlet, specify my service name, and a couple of minutes later, I've got this environment up and running again. That, to me, is very cool. All right, so let's move back to the slide deck. Well, let's just quickly look if that's come back. No, we've still got one cloud service at the moment. All right, so we've been through that. We've talked about cloud services. What I want to talk about in the last 20 minutes or so is a hybrid deployment. So a hybrid deployment is this concept where we're now essentially creating a virtualized branch office out in a virtual network within infrastructure as a service. So there's a couple of additional concepts that we're going to have to introduce to this so that you can understand how it works. So we'll talk a little bit about virtual networks. We've already spoken a little bit about affinity groups. So again, an affinity group is just a way of signaling to the fabric controller that these virtual machines that you're creating in the context of these affinity groups, they're going to be communicating with each other, so please go and locate them close to each other in the data center. Availability sets gives a further instruction to the controller, and I'll show you how that works in a moment, but essentially it's around fault domains and up domains. So if I've got a particular tier, so for example, my application tier, and I've got multiple servers within that tier, what I want to make sure is that there's not a single point of failure. So there's two things that are going to happen. So one is, if those servers on that same tier are both in the same rack and there's a top of rack switch failure, or maybe the power supply goes down, I'm going to lose that whole tier. So what I'd actually ideally want is for those to be located on different racks, so that if one of them goes down, I've still got that tier up and running. So availability sets lets me signal to the fabric controller to please go and put these in different racks. The second thing that it does is that the platform is going to get updated fairly regularly underneath your feet. And what you don't want, again, is I've got a tier within my deployment, and I've got two servers within that tier, and they're both on the same update domain, which means that they're going to get updated at the same time, which means that I'm going to lose my service for the duration of that update. So again, specifying an availability set ensures that the platform is going to be updated at different times for those virtual machines. And then I'm going to talk a little bit about AD replication. Yep. No, you put them in the same availability set. Okay. So by putting them in the same availability set, what you're saying is these things collectively are providing a service, and please make sure that at least one of them stays running. Exactly right, yeah. So, and we'll talk about that SQL Server cluster in a moment. So here's my hybrid site-to-site configuration that I'm building out. So there's two ways that you can connect to services within Azure. You can either connect point-to-point, so using Azure Connect. What that's going to require you to do is to go and actually install an agent on your local machine, and you can connect a local machine to a machine that you've got running up in, or a web role or a work role that you've got running up in Azure. The second way that you've got, which is more recent and which I'm utilizing over here, is a site-to-site connection. So this is exactly like a branch office where I'm creating a VP tunnel over IPsec. and I'm extending my domain out onto this virtual network in the cloud. So this this is actually fairly easy to set up, and I'll walk you through the process in a moment. It's very easy to set up on the Azure side. On the other side, and it's basically going to give you everything that you need, just a word of warning, your VPN device on-premise or with your ISP needs to be either Cisco or Juniper at the moment. So if you've got a Cisco or Juniper device, it's going to give you all the configuration that you need to go ahead and configure that device. That part I left to our device actually sits with our ISP, and when he started saying to me that I could actually go and configure it off a telnet prompt if I wanted, my developer head started going a little bit queasy, and I said, you do that. And he did it, and once we got it up and running, it's been really, really stable. So the next thing we want to do is build out our subnet. So again, as I mentioned earlier, right now, as the platform is in its current incarnation, there's actually no real value to creating multiple subnets in the context of the same virtual network. So first of all, regardless of what subnet the virtual machine's on, they're automatically going to be able to communicate to each other, assuming, of course, you've opened the appropriate access through the firewall. I'm putting them in over here because it's good practice, and it's an anticipation of the point where you can actually control the routing of traffic between those subnets. Okay, so here's our AD replica. So what I've put in place is AD with integrated DNS. So you might ask, well, why do we actually want that over there if we've actually got this VPN tunnel, and I can just specify that as my primary DNS? So the value of that, of course, is if I've got it up in the cloud with integrated DNS, then every virtual machine on each of these virtual network subnets is actually going to look to that as the domain authority. So it's reducing traffic across this wide area network over here. And so you're getting some fault tolerance from that as well. If that VPN tunnel goes down for some reason, I can still actually authenticate against my services running up in the cloud, even though I'm not actually connected back through to on-premise. I thought it was good enough to put one of those up there because I've got the redundancy from, you know, if that one goes down over there or is being updated, I can just specify my secondary DNS as the on-premise, and that can go across to that authority. Okay, so this is what you were talking about a moment ago with your SQL Server tier. So obviously if I want that automatic failover, so if one of those is being, if the platform is being updated underneath one of those, I'm going to need a witness to make sure that I've got automatic failover. So now this is my understanding as it currently is, right? So we're running SQL 2012, and obviously ideally what I'd like is to set over a failover group, especially with a multi-database environment like SharePoint and E5. So I can actually specify that whole set of databases as a group and they'll fail over together. At the moment, and this is my understanding currently, and it may have already changed, so don't quote me to this on this or hold me to it, but my understanding is that you can't set up a, so you can set up a failover group, but you can't set up a listener on that group at the moment for automatic failover within infrastructure as a service, which is why over here I've actually indicated a full quorum. So I've got two Mirror partners and a witness over here for that automatic failover. So again, what you want to make sure is that this tier over here is on the same availability set, and that'll make sure that, you know, if there's a power failure, they'll be in different racks, and that they'll be updated at different times, so you can maintain that tier. So the second part I'm building out is my app tier. So over here, I'm running SharePoint Central Admin on this tier over here. I'm running my E5 services, and I'm hosting the E5 services that I'm connecting to, as you saw earlier on, within E5 Studio. And then I'm going to build out my load balanced front-end servers. So how do I then expose those to the outside world? Well, I load balance on port 80 and port 443, and I distribute that load across those two servers. So load balancing, I mean, if you guys have mucked about with network load balancing before and other load balancing devices, it's just, especially for a developer, non-IT pro like myself, this is just an absolute pleasure. It's so easy to specify those endpoints and specify that you want the load distributed across that. So you saw on that command shell script that there was that add Azure endpoint, so it's very easy to set that up with the private and public port. And then you can also go and specify that you want it to be part of a load balance set, and that just distributes that load via round robin. The other thing that you can do when you create your load balanced endpoints is that you can actually specify a probing path as well. So you can specify a resource that you'd like the load balancer to actually go and hit, so you can actually control over whether or not you want traffic being routed to that server or not. So you may want to go and monitor CPU load or memory or something like that, and set some thresholds and say, okay, if it's past a certain point over here, I'm actually going to, basically, as long as that resource is returning at 200, it's going to send traffic to there. If you return any other response, it's not going to send traffic through to that server. And then the other thing that I've opened up over here is some additional ports, through to my application tier. So I've got my E5 services hosted on port 85 for E5 Studio, and that just happens to be the port number that I've used for central admin. So if I wanted to expose those to the public internet as well, I can do that. I might not want to do it over HTTP, but anyway. Okay, so let me just walk you through some of that over the last 10 minutes. So I've begun putting this environment together. So what you can see over here is I've got a virtual network called DSA Azure. So DSA is standing for Datarack Services Australia. And over here you can see my three subnets that I've created. And you can specify, so it's pretty easy. If you do this through the management portal, it'll walk you through the process and say, okay, well, I want a new virtual network. This is what I'm going to call it. These are the subnets that I want. These are the address ranges that I want in those subnets. And it'll go ahead and stand all that up for you. Over here, I can see, so I've got some indication of my data flowing in and out. I've got my gateway IP address. So once I've created this virtual network in the cloud and I want to actually connect it back on premise, there's three key pieces of information that I'm going to have to get hold of so that I can go and actually configure that Cisco device. So I don't know if any of you guys were at Mark Washam's session on Wednesday on virtual machines and virtual networks, but he actually, if you want to see how this is done, he actually live set up the whole virtual network and actually configured his Cisco device back in Washington remotely via RDP, and the whole thing worked. So I was pretty impressed. He's a braver man than me. I'll tell you what, once I had this thing up and running, there was no ways I was going to touch it. So over here, you can see the different resources that I've got running here. So I've got these virtual machine roles. You can see the AD replica over there that you saw in that diagram. And that is sitting in its own cloud service. And then you'll notice that all these other ones are sitting in their own cloud service down over here. So that's the DNS name by which I'm accessing these services. I can see the IP addresses on the different subnets. If I now go and look at that cloud service, so there you go. So that sandbox has appeared. You notice that over there? So that means that that has actually been deleted, and we'll just complete this script and go and remove that service. I hope you can still remember the context of that, and it's going to ask me for a confirmation, and that'll go ahead and delete that cloud service that was created for that standalone virtual machine and free up that name on the DNS. So E5HO demo is the DNS name for this hybrid multi-server environment that I've provisioned. And I can go and take a look at the health of that cloud service, and I can see the instances that I've got running on it. So there I've got my SQL server, so I haven't set up that full quorum as yet. You are limited on the preview as to how much resource you can use. I think you get a total of 20 CPU, and there are some other limitations. So I've been distributing those over different things as I've been doing it. So there's my SQL server, I've got my application server, and I've got my two web front ends with the load balanced across that on those endpoints. So this is the interesting thing to take note of over here. So we were talking about availability sets, right? So you'll notice over here we've got update domain and fault domain, and here's my web front end 2 and my web front end 2, web front end 1. And because I've specified the same availability group for those two servers on that tier, you'll notice that it's actually on two different update domains and two different fault domains. So what this is telling me over here is that this virtual machine over here is guaranteed to be on a different rack to that virtual machine over there. And again, that one over there is guaranteed to be on a different upgrade timetable, platform upgrade timetable to that one over there. So again, if I scale up my my app tier, I'm going to want to make sure that I specify the same availability set name, and that'll then make sure that those are on different update and fault domains. So if we have a look at those endpoints that we've got provisioned. And again, setting this up is really easy through the management portal, and it's also really easy, as you saw, through the PowerShell commandlet. So over here, I've got two endpoints set up, the one for RDP traffic and the other for HTTP over port 80. And you'll notice over here that it says that that's load balanced. So if I go across to web front end 2, you see that it's got the same endpoint specified on port 80. So if you want to see that working, what I actually did, we can go across that quickly. Because again, being my cynical self, I thought, okay, well, how do I know it's actually balancing that traffic? So what I did was I went, so this is the E5 instance that's actually being hosted at e5hademo.cloudapp.net. And is that what I want? Yes. So what I did was I just went to the global master page and I just put the name of the server up at the top there. So you can see there I'm on web front end 2. If I go and hit another page over here, it usually goes straight to, so that's gone straight to web front end 1. So it's just distributing those requests, spraying them across that tier in a round robin fashion. Okay, the last thing that I want to show you is just to walk you through a PowerShell script. Here's a little script over here. Actually, there's two more that I want to show you. So what this script will do over here is, so we saw that one where we could export the configuration of a specific virtual machine. What I can also do is go up to a service and say, okay, for this cloud service over here, so we'll actually execute that quickly. So I'm going to specify that service. I'm going to specify a path to a folder where I want these configuration files to go. Then I'm going to go and get that Azure VM, and I'm going to just pop them through this for each over here and write out the service name, the virtual machine name, .config, so that I can get the configuration of all the virtual machines running on this service. Okay. Whoops. Didn't like that. Okay, well, anyway, there's that script over there. It does actually usually work. And it just loops through the virtual machines on that cloud service and it'll spit out that configuration. So then you can do the corollary of that again and you can go and import that environment. So this is a script over here that I'll just very quickly walk you through. But what this one does is, so we saw earlier on when I looked at my images within the management portal that I had a base application server, and what I want to be able to do is just execute a script so I can scale up that tier, and that script would look something like this. So I'm going to specify that image name. So if I'm not sure what the image names are, I can go and execute this get Azure VM image and select the image name. And that'll list out all the images that I've got available to me. So what you're seeing over there is all the platform images and plus my images, including my E5 app server, which is the one that I'm going to use here. I specify the IP, so the primary IP of my DNS replica that I've got up in the cloud. I specify the name. I go in over here and create a new Azure DNS for that to use. I specify my VN name. I did actually have some domain admin passwords and things in here, but I thought it was probably wiser to obfuscate those. I specify the name of my domain. I specify the subnet that I want to create this virtual machine on. I specify the media location. So remember, when there's an image, it's a read-only image. And when I new up a VM, it's actually going to take a copy of that VHD. This is specifying where I want that copy to go, and it'll boot up the virtual machine off that. And I'm then piping through this VM config over here, specifying my endpoints, and I'm actually specifying that I want to actually join it to my on-premise domain and passing through the necessary credentials to do that. And then I'm specifying the service name that I want this to be joined to. And then when I execute this new Azure VM commandlet and I pass it the service name that I want to join to, I pass through the VM configuration with all the commandlets to say that I want to join the domain and the DNS settings. When I execute that, it'll actually stand up that, set up a new virtual machine off that base image, join it to my domain, join it to that application tier. You'll see over here I've specified the availability set name, so that E5HA demo apps is the availability set that I've already created for that other application service that'll make sure that it provisions it on a different fault and update domain. And bing, a couple of minutes later, I've got a new member. I've basically scaled up that tier with a PowerShell script. And I think Whoops, let's jump back to the deck. That brings us to the end, yeah. So thanks so much for coming. Really appreciate your time. Hope it's been helpful and informative. Please do fill out the evals. I'd really like to have a look at those. It's useful to me. And you can still apparently win one of these Sculpt Touch mouses, which I'm told are awesome. Keep learning. So resources on Channel 9. You guys have seen all this stuff before. But this session, all the other sessions are going to be up there. You can download the slide decks as well. And that's it. Thanks so much. Thank you.